Hello, it's Tamara Kresmiansky from ADDAD. That's ADDAD.org. And this is one of our Corona series. You can find the other calls from Corona at ADDAD.org/Corona. And we have things on all different aspects of Corona. It's affecting lots of people. We're all in the same storm, as they say, but we're all in different boats. We have different situations that are on our minds. And so we're tackling many of these and addressing many of the situations. So I'm really excited that Dr. Elka Pinson is available to talk to us about supporting your spouse through corona trauma. Dr. Pinson has worked with us before and has always interesting insight, and I love our conversation. So we're going to jump right into that. When we say corona trauma, what are we referring to?
Okay. Well, I don't know. I haven't heard that it's an official term or other people's definition of it, but my functional definition of it makes the most sense to me. Obviously, people can have all sorts of experiences now. Not all of us, thank God, have corona or are ill with corona or have any specific medical or physical interaction with corona, although we're aware of it. So it seems to me that the best definition would be corona trauma means any trauma or event that is associated with this corona pandemic, meaning it could be your lifestyle, it could be financial, it could be anything that is directly impacted and as a result of corona at this time anyway.
Let's define what trauma means, not corona associated.
Okay. Well, trauma is a very, very big term. And, you know, of course, we all use the common use is sort of like something. Because traumatic to me, and we mean by that, something was just very, very, very hard or difficult or challenging. But the official definition of trauma has more to do with a reaction to very, very significant events. Most of us understand that trauma, that certain events are by definition traumatic, meaning earthquakes and car crashes, one might say are by definition traumatic. But actually trauma doesn't lie in the event, although that there is always an event precipitating trauma, but trauma lies in the person and how they respond to an event. And that could vary tremendously. And, of course, trauma could be from these big events, from these awful, horrific, dangerous events, to things that may not be considered dangerous or directly dangerous, but may be so profound for that person that they experience it as if it was a major, perhaps life, a dangerous or threatening event. So the trauma it's sort of like, it resides in the person and how they've internalized an experience.
So what would trauma look like on someone or how if they have experienced this as a trauma?
I'm sorry, what was the question with the bad connection?
Someone does experience an event as a trauma, what would be going on for them?
Okay, so a trauma, let's go back to, you know, just because we're talking about corona trauma. So just to go back to what somebody could experience within this complex we call corona trauma, it could be, of course, having a medical condition and the actual disease itself, or being closely associated with somebody else who does, you know, whether it's your parent or your child or yourself, of course. Then you have all the concomitant things which are within that catchment again. Perhaps the fear of infection or the frustrations that you encounter being at home or loss of a job. So any of those things could be stressors. Inadequate supplies might be another one. Financial loss might be another one. Any long duration of quarantine, isolation could be traumatizing. So all of those can either be stressors contributing to trauma or traumatizing in and of themselves. The thing about trauma is that even though anybody might acknowledge an event as being horrible, It's not so simple to assume that somebody will be traumatized by it. And we know this from 9/11, that when the towers were hit and the lower Manhattan was really decimated, only I think a third of the people who were directly impacted could be clinically diagnosed as traumatized. Of course, they were all upset, distressed, and under a tremendous amount of stress and pressure afterwards. But they weren't traumatized. It didn't stop them or interfere with their functioning. It was just bad. So there's an interesting concept here that how one is at the moment of trauma or how one enters the traumatic event or situation will somewhat dictate how they get through it and survive afterwards. What would be seen in somebody who is affected by trauma would be anything from the range, depending on what it is and when it is and how it is, of course, anything in the range from dissociated experiences to emotional blankness or hyperreactivity and anxiety, any sort of emotional, it kind of goes to more or less any sort of emotional expression could be within the basket of trauma. It could be depression. It could be dysfunction. It could be, of course, somebody might deal with it in maladaptive ways. So you might see something like drug or other substance abuse to manage the trauma. So many behaviors or other kinds of addictive behaviors, for example, could be managing trauma as opposed to being just a problem in their own right. So there are a lot of cover-ups of trauma. The trauma resides in the person, in their body, in their thinking, in their emotional life, in their belief system somewhat. That's the core of what the problem is.
So what would be the role of a loved one, or in this case a spouse, if they're noticing some of these things? And again, I'm assuming that it doesn't really matter. We don't have to diagnose it as trauma. But if they're presenting with some of these emotions.
So let me go on about this a little bit. Now, generally speaking, because, you know, the idea of trauma, again, I'm going to take it from the clinical direction and not from the street use of the term, because, you know, that's why I'm here. We don't diagnose trauma by virtue of a bad thing happened to a person, even though we would all agree that was a bad thing. We diagnose trauma usually a few months after. So really, if a bad thing happens to a person, and assuming that they did have a reaction to it or they are distressed by it, the diagnosis is usually something called acute stress disorder. They are acting stressed. How will that manifest? It might manifest in a sleep disorder or an eating weight loss or gain or irritability or preoccupation, any kinds of anxiety or behavior problems. Over a period of time, that might or might not result in the picture of trauma. And what's interesting here is that you have a window right after these bad events where the experience is still kind of fragmented within the individual's psyche. And so there's a nice window of time there in which you can do intervention and help them and not have it consolidate into a traumatic core. So what you would see in the beginning would be these sort of soft things, these irritability, and these, you don't usually see things like flashbacks and dramatic reactions in the beginning. Usually you just get a lot of agitation and sort of obvious distress, perhaps tearfulness. You get the in fact, I've dealt with traumatized individuals who in the beginning really don't feel or see anything different. Their life goes on. People came back from wars and everything was sort of okay. They did their job. They came back. And then a number of months later, it hit them. And that's when the event was sort of consolidated in their psyche, and it's actually harder to get rid of at that point. You need a lot deeper form of treatment then. So early intervention is really, really helpful with this kind of problem.
So early intervention, is that something that the family can do before, or is it something like what can a family member or spouse do?
Okay, so we're talking again, right? We're talking very generally, right? So of course, it depends on what the situation is. Now, most people, the people who experience trauma, tend to be. It's also kind of interesting when you look at who is traumatized by an event versus who is, assuming that they're both in this pretty much the same event, right? A few people, you know, a bunch of people in the same event, the ones who will most likely be traumatized are the ones who do not, who feel helpless. The people who go in being equipped and helpful, let's say first responders, tend to be less traumatized because they have a role, they have a focus, they have some sense of self-efficacy, they could do things, and so they are equipped better than the, you know, the regular person, you know, the lay person, right? So again, now, not all events, not all difficult, challenging events will be responded to in trauma, but of course there are differences between them. If somebody, for example, in COVID trauma, it's obviously quite different if somebody themselves was physically ill with it and therefore vulnerable to trauma versus somebody who was not physically ill, but perhaps they lost a job or perhaps they had some other, you know, hardship associated with it. So it's probably better to figure out what was the traumatizing event, the precipitant to the problem. And if it's one, you go in one direction, and if it's the other, you go in another, of course. So the treatment would depend, of course, on the event, perhaps if you lost a job. The best thing you could do would be to go to a job counselor, you know, assuming that happened and you're distressed by it and perhaps will be or perhaps won't be traumatized by it, the first thing you do, if possible, is to just go into reparative action. Now, if you can't go into that action, if you are stuck because of the loss, because of the challenge, because of emotional upheaval, then, of course, you need some mental health help. And, of course, on an individual basis, that help will be tailored to what your particular issue is here. Trauma, when it gets right down to it, when I treat trauma clients, what I find, and this is irrelevant to what kind of trauma they've experienced, even though, of course, each of these, as I've said, each of these are different situations. You know, if you were physically ill or if you were the victim of something else. But one of the things that's pretty consistent is that all people, traumatized people, and in fact all of us to some degree, have different belief systems that are associated with how we felt at the moment of trauma. Not how we felt, I'm sorry, how we see ourselves at the moment of trauma. At the moment of trauma, the prevailing belief about ourselves, that prevailing belief could be anything from I deserved this negative belief, to a prevailing negative belief of I have no power or control or, you know, voice in this, to the negative belief of I can't trust anybody or these sorts of people. They fall into different areas of belief, negative beliefs, and that's what gets us stuck because our logical mind knows this happened to us. It's a bad thing that happened to us. Logically, we could all say we just got sick and it was, we lost our job or it had nothing to do with us. But on a deep level, if we're traumatized, we have a belief about ourselves that kind of keeps that trauma going internally, a negative belief about ourselves. So the treatment would focus on that usually anyway. And that's it, kind of in a nutshell. Now, what would we do to help such a person? Of course, there's lots of options. And again, it depends on what the particular problem is. If it's a problem with needing support by other people, if it's a problem with other family members, if it's a problem with one's own mental health and functioning. You know, there's sort of a lot of directions to go in here. Let's see, where else? But that critical period is very, very important. I can't stress that enough, to not wait until something becomes entrenched, but to, you know, kind of pull it back before it takes on a life of its own.
So if the spouse is noticing that they're starting to get irritable, and there's a kind of obvious, and like if someone lost a job, in addition to Corona, I mean, you call it Corona, but in addition to it,
yeah,
and they're acting particularly irritable, then the spouse can or ought to jump in and do something.
Right.
But she or he may not know what it is. They just, the need is, to do something is obvious, or, you know, somewhat obvious. What might the spouse do at that point? What I would suggest is go speak to a professional to know what your role is. But what might they do even before that? Like, should they bring it up? I see you are acting irritable.
Yeah.
Or should they?
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah. Well, look, you know, it's like the elephant in the room. If somebody's acting irritable, you can't not bring it up. The question is it going to dominate, the situation or not? I mean, obviously, whatever is brought up has to be done in a tactful way and in a thoughtful way. The issue is, first of all, to kind of, to deal with things rapidly, but in a timely way. It's understandable that somebody would be irritable. Many of these responses, by the way, are very normal responses. To be irritable after you lost a job, for Pete's sake, of course you should be irritable. It's expected. If you didn't care, it would be kind of odd. But can you move past it? Are we past it? Or are we taking it personally? Are we taking it, you know, let's say in the COVID or Corona, time frame. If we're taking it personally, that's illogical, right? Because it's happening so broadly, and that's actually a protective element of this, which, because we're in a collective trauma. It's not aimed at you or me. It's a whole society, essentially. But so if somebody is taking it personally, that's a sign for concern. Right? If the irritability is precluding moving to the next step, if it's a contagion in the home, remember all of these moods and feelings are contagious within a home or family or within a couple. So these things have to be really addressed, you know, pretty soon, as much as possible, because it's not that this person. It's not even an issue that this person is entitled to something so much as that the rest of the family should suffer as a result of it, you know, so a spouse, of course, should be supportive, and of course, I mean, needless to say, should be supportive, and talking about it is usually the right thing, but when and how and in what words is obviously important, and what the real issue is, in other words, if somebody is down because they don't have a job, the logic would say go get a job, you know, go look for one. But if that can't happen, then something else is going on. You know?
While it's harder to know exactly what to say, there are certain things that are really not helpful to say.
Right.
Or not helpful to do. Can you
talk
to that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, you know, in most of these situations, and because we're primarily, most of us are first exceptions, we want to, you know, I think.
Elka, we're losing your voice.
Okay. I don't know what you heard before, so okay.
Okay.
From people in a firm community, we're able to often put this into a framework of belief and spiritual framework, and that's what a gift that we have and a wonderful thing that we're able to do. Nonetheless, it's not usually helpful to point out to people that it's part of God's plan. Not usually, because they usually know it. And usually it's more helpful to help people find their own strengths and positive coping that they can access or find either within themselves or provide them with positive opportunities. Because the reality is that the feeling of being unable to do things, incapable, is an awful feeling. And by kind of saying it's in, Hashem's hands, it's kind of saying, well, you know, there's not much you could do anyway. That's not real encouraging. So encouragement, obviously, is really the way to go. Reasonable amounts of patience, reasonable amount of provision of resources. Support is great. It doesn't have to necessarily be from a spouse. It could be from somebody else that might have a nice touch with your, you know, with your spouse, a nice rapport. And keeping the big picture, which is that if one person is suffering from, and again, we're using this job loss thing, but that's not the only, stressor. But if that happens, then there are certainly other people, which means, let's keep it in perspective. It isn't you, perspective, right? And to listen carefully and to listen between the lines, not to just jump on what somebody's saying, but listen carefully and hear what they're not saying. And that's really, really important. What are they not saying? Because usually people will say, I can't, but often they mean, I'm afraid. Or they'll say, things along that line. I won't call them excuses, but they're definitely ways of representing themselves that are not totally accurate. So when you have somebody, and it could be, somebody else in this situation, in these challenging situations, there's a lot of, I'm trying to think of another example maybe, there's a lot of potential for self-blame, for feeling of perhaps excessive responsibility for things. For negativity, even though this may be totally not in their control, so it's kind of hard to live with. Now, of course, it depends on what the spouse is going through, because we can't talk about one spouse without assuming that the other spouse also has challenges and also has things to deal with. And particularly in this, in which everybody's got their plate full. Everybody's got some more than they need to handle, whether it be the kids or small living quarters or illness, God forbid, or whatever, So everybody's got something going on here, and one could imagine that this is very, very stressful for, many, many families. And certainly things going on with the children themselves. So it's, obviously everybody's got plenty going on, and calm listening and calm talking are key here, really key on a daily basis,
Yeah, I would imagine that words like snap out of it or my brother is not doing it.
No. If somebody is really, really knocked off out of balance, snapping out of it is not only is it sound dismissive, but it's totally impossible. I mean, it's really impossible if somebody is traumatized. Now, again, remember, trauma takes time to settle in. If we're talking about people who have had bad experience, let's say now, let's talk about the COVID trauma. We're in the middle of it, and we're all in it at the same time in the same place, literally. So basically, we know what's going on. It's not over. It's still active, and we don't even know what's going to be happening within the next days or weeks. There's a lot of wiggle room now. There's a lot of room to improve things, to think about things in a better way, so that even when this ends, by the time it ends, we will not say it was easy, and we won't say that it wasn't uncomfortable or even miserable for many people. Nonetheless, by the time it ends, there's potential to get out of it with strength and with new skills and with new perspectives. It doesn't mean that we have to kind of get dragged down now until you know, it's 100% over. In fact, now's the time to start thinking of the next step. You know, what's going to be next? How are we going to handle this? Instead of waiting. Waiting would probably be the worst thing. We're waiting for certain things, of course, but we don't have to wait to change our attitudes or our perspectives or our skills or our connections. That we don't have to wait for at all. What we have to do is wait to socialize in, you know, in public, you know. So there's a lot that can be done even now. It doesn't have to consolidate into trauma.
Okay, so this question came in related. My spouse is feeling very guilty that they led their father, to the hospital, and he's really not getting better there. And he's feeling guilty that they didn't do something different for the father.
Well, okay, so the first question would be, what else might you have done? And the possible answer there would be, there's probably not much you could have done. I mean, it may be awful. It certainly is awful that he's in the hospital and that it feels very negative. But is there truly anything you could have done? I mean, I would ask that question. What could you have done? If you yourself are not a medical person and you yourself do not have the resources to do something dramatically different, you know, then how could you blame yourself or feel guilty over doing that which is, you know, generally thought of as the right thing to do? Were there other options? You know, so there's a lot. Okay, so that's all very logical, right? And logic is important to you. You have to kind of use your head. It's logical. If that's what the doctor's ordered and you're not a doctor, you follow their orders. Are there alternatives? So it's possible, and again, this is all new, so I'm throwing this out, the possibility that the guilt is old guilt from you know, years ago, or about other aspects of the relationship, or about something else that may be rearing its head and kind of coming up now. Is it truly guilt, or is it just sadness and concern? You see, there's a lot of variations here. Because if you're doing the quote-unquote right thing, why would you feel guilty? What's the guilt? I would think you'd feel guilty if you don't do that thing. So there's something else cooking here. And that's what I would want to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'm going to just extrapolate from that question. But there, people are saying, like, do AMA, like, get them out of the hospital, like, and you're not doing that, or you didn't do that, and they passed, or whatever it is. That whole other people were managed to keep their parent out of the hospital and gave them medication and home, and we didn't do that. And, you know, all of that whole, you know, thing around what other people are saying and all this buzz on the internet and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, well, there's a tremendous amount out there of pressure and counter pressure to do things a certain way, whether it be a medical protocol or a lot of politics involved here as well. A tremendous amount of politics that's not always evident, but a lot of the news and the fake news has agendas. Okay, and it's very, very vicious. It's very important to not be swayed or sucked into a lot of it, if only because it's very hard for even professionals to discern which is the vicious, you know, kind of misinformation and which is not. One can only make the best decision you can at the time, you know, and it may not be, and most of the time, most people don't make perfect decisions because we're not in a perfect world. So the question is, if the guilt is true guilt, and not just, remember, guilt, you know, we use these words, but we have to really know, is it guilt, I did something wrong, or is it more like regret, well, you know, perhaps I wasn't aware of other options, or is it more like just plain old sadness because it doesn't look like it's working really well, I did the best I could, but it's not really working well. So kind of find that line between what's really going on, right? Because guilt in and of itself it really does not accomplish a darn thing. And it's sort of an indulgence in a certain kind of way because it really can't accomplish anything. But now, if indeed there is responsibility that was not, let's say this person says, no, I was responsible and I made the wrong decision. Okay, that could happen in life. However, given all the factors that we know about decision-making and reality and pressures and all the other things that come up in life, which are many and endless, it's possible that being more forgiving of yourself might be more helpful to the picture than more critical of yourself, right? Because, you know, the guilt gets you nowhere, but, you know, and being self-critical is a better way of living, but not too much, right? So, again, if it persists, then you need help. Then you need professional help. Because if it persists and it can't be balanced by thoughts that you did the best you could at the time, with the best knowledge you had at the time, then it could become a very depressing. Sometimes you get with that, you get somebody who has like prolonged mourning, you know, like prolonged grief, where after a typical period of mourning, let's say after somebody passes, somebody goes into this sort of endless grief, which is just not typical and excessive. So whenever something is excessive, we get a little suspicious, like what purpose is this excessive bad thing serving? Mm-hmm. So I think in that case, maybe a bit of help. And it might be help with some other people who've gone through similar, you know, they've been in similar challenges and they know from inside what happened and how that you know, how it goes. Nobody could become a brilliant medical knowledgeable person all of a sudden and make all the right calls. That's ridiculous. Why would one think that they could do that? So there's a lot of suppressed stuff that does come up when somebody is in these situations. Old business.
I think the word that at that time, you made the best decision with the information you had at that time, is so critical, mm-hmm. that, you know, with this ever-changing...
Right now. Yeah, right. We're living in a situation. How nobody would ever dream that we would be in this situation. So how could we possibly prepare for it?
Right. So even though we may know things a little bit differently now that we're 6-8 weeks in, but if you have to make a decision 2 weeks in, there was less information, so you made the best decision with the information you had at that time.
Absolutely. Very important to keep things in context, not take them out of context. You know, we're not living in this, you know, perfect world where we can kind of, if this and if that. Well, if this and that were not available to us at that time, you know. So it's nice to think about, but it's, you know, it doesn't make sense. Maybe now
this question also came in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. About not being there when their loved one passed, and they're having a hard time with that, or the loved one passed in the hospital alone. So wrapping their head around that, whether it's for that the loved one was alone, or that they themselves were not there and didn't have closure yet.
Okay, so I was thinking about this, and, you know, it kind of, I was just trying to think, is this like, it's, you know, for us, it's not the standard way. It's not typical. However, in at war times, it's quite typical. Over history, it has been more typical than we're remembering. And certainly I'm not, you know, encouraging people going to war. But, you know, soldiers and people who went abroad, you know, in wars, or who left their families as immigrants and went to the new world or the new country or wherever, you know, all the time passed away without our being present or, you know, available to them. So there is a model for it. It's not, in fact, if somebody had gone to war, didn't return, as sad as it was, we might never even have the opportunity to know about it until sometime after, or to have any form of funeral or burial at all. So I think there is some precedent for it. It's not, and I think that might be a reasonable way to think about it, you know. It's not that you weren't there because you didn't want to be there. that you weren't there because it was not safe nor possible under the circumstances. It's not that you made no effort, right? So the question is, if this person persists, right? This is the truth. This is logic and straight out logic, and I think all of us would probably agree to that. But if this person persists in feeling, being self, very judgmental and very, self-critical and despondent over this, that means something else is going on, something behind our eyes about what it would have meant to them or why, or some thought about, a belief about themselves, why they didn't do it, And that needs to be addressed because, now if it's coming from, I had no power, well, that's true. In this case, you didn't have power. That's a fact. But if that's a recurrent theme in that person's life, I never had power, I never could accomplish, I never could do certain things, then this is just piggybacking on those old, accumulated events. And let's face it, even though all of us are coming in as equally miserable participants in COVID trauma, right? We all, we're all equal, right? We all have an equal opportunity to get, However, we're not all equal in the sense of what our backgrounds are. We're not all equal in terms of what we've gone through in life. We've all had different experiences. We've all had different peccalos. We've all had different, some of us have had previous traumas of all sorts. And so when a new event hits, it could be piggybacking on earlier issues, right? And if 10% or 20% of the population has some kind of mental health issue or is taking antidepressants or what have you, so this too can we're not clean slates, This is on top of all the rest of life, right? So if something persists and it's burdensome, whether it's just burdensome to you in your mind or it presents a burden to the family in some way or it's impeding, having a good life, then some professional help could certainly address that.
Okay, let's talk, when we're talking a little bit about grief, can we talk a little bit about the typical grief cycle so someone can know if something else is excessive?
Okay. Okay, so grief. So grief is, I was kind of thinking again about this. Well, grief, there's books written about grief, and some of the classics that says, well, there's 5 stages of grief, and somebody else tells that there's 7 stages. I'll just read you all the various stages, and then make a comment. Now, the stages that have usually been identified are, let me just read them to you, okay? There's usually, initially, there's shock, which may or may not be there depending on the circumstance, but there's shock, denial or isolation, meaning this can't be happening or I don't believe this is happening or, it's not real in some way. There's naturally pain, guilt, anger, bargaining or testing, sort of whether or not you believe in God, I guess there's a certain sense of, of negotiation in the mind. There is often depression or loneliness. There's a process or a time of reconstruction or working through, kind of refiguring things out, what it was about, what had happened, how it happened, who you are, and so forth. There's acceptance, and there is hope, hopefully at the end, hope. And hope often comes from making or finding meaning in the loss, because grief obviously comes after or as a result of loss usually of a person. Now, remember, and I just want to throw this in because I think it's important. We're very familiar with the idea of grief because somebody died. Okay, that's kind of a simple thing. But remember, grief could also could come from the loss of anything and anybody, right? Loss, we all experience loss in kinds of ways. We lose roles in life. We lose opportunities. We lose stages or of life, or we lose experiences. Life is full of loss. Now, so keep in mind that a lot of these might even apply to those. Loss is everywhere. But grief, grieving for a person, is an internal experience, and all these different things that I've mentioned about shock and denial and acceptance and all those things. While a lot of the theorists say, you know, it's in a sequence, first this, then that, the fact is it could be a mishmash. It could come, a lot of things can come up and back and sideways, and basically people who are going through the grief process have good days and bad days, and up and down, and it's in their mind and it's not in their mind. So, you know, I think assumptions about how you should grieve, if you should grieve, when you should grieve, are you know, what does it mean, what it would look like to other people, I would be very flexible about that. You know, some people are stoic, some people are quiet, some people are criers. So there's room for everybody, right? Mourning is a little bit different. Mourning is more outward, right? How we mourn. And I think the biggest problem, as I've observed it regarding this COVID trauma, is the lack of the structured mourning that Shiva provides, or Shiva with family provides. I think if anything, this is probably the biggest difficulty for many, many people, because they kind of feel like it ended and there's not much they can do to commemorate at that, you know, in that week. And I think that the idea of commemoration is probably a good one to just keep in mind, to find another way, another time, and ways to commemorate so that the mourning has some structure and some form. It's not just done away with. We didn't erase mourning. We just have to find new ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question that came in about jobs, okay. And I'm gonna switch it up a little bit.
Okay.
This one is writing that my husband finally got a job and now he lost it. I'm afraid he's not gonna get another job.
Well, okay, so that's awful, right? Now, of course, if it's true he won't, or if it's just a fear, that's significant, right? A fear is just a feeling, not just a feeling, but it's a feeling. It might be a belief, but it's not necessarily true. Fear is understandable. Change your thinking, change your language. Think of the word concern. I am concerned he won't get another job. Oh, that you could do something about. A concern means you could address the concern. You could do things about the concern. Fear means from a trauma perspective, fear is paralysis. Fear is running away. Fear is getting into a fight, okay? What we want is thinkiness, right? Not neurological, we don't want to be locked into panic or fear. We want to move forward. So if you think how to handle something, if you can. Now, if the fear is paralyzing, in fact, because you are paralyzed, that, you know, it does happen. Then we need to talk about that, right? What is the fear? Is that turning into negativity? Is it going to be communicated in a way that's going to be destructive? You know, so how are you using the word fear? I guess that would be really important here. Mm-hmm. We don't know. Maybe he'll get a better job. Certainly does happen, you know? It must have been very hard to wait for this job. Well, if it happened once, it could happen again. So depending on the details and the variables in this situation, it you know, you've got to look at it one way or another, you know. It's hard to be too general, or, you know, it's because it's kind of the devil's in the details, you know, with these sorts of things. Is it your fear or is it the reality of the situation? Well, then the reality has to be addressed, you know, that's in the way, you know.
Elka, I'm wondering, is there a difference between the way men and women experience events or traumatic events, and what might be the role of the other gender spouse? Or is it women all the same, it's just individual to individual?
I'm thinking about that. I've never come across anything specific. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I've never come across anything to talk about the different reactions of men and women. to traumatic events. I don't know if I just looked in the wrong places or what have you. I would suspect that it's pretty similar, but that men and women might have different negative beliefs about themselves in response to bad. In other words, when bad things the same bad thing happens to a man or a woman, might result in different cognitions. A man might respond to something with, I can't control things, and a woman might likely respond to the same thing with, I don't deserve things, something like that. But I don't know. This stuff is it's probably worthy of research, but I don't know if there's a big difference in how people respond.
And is there a big difference? Is there a difference in the way a spouse, a wife, should support her husband, or a husband should support his wife?
Not really.
okay.
Support either, right? Not really. I mean, everybody needs someone to listen. Everybody needs someone to encourage. Everybody needs someone to give them warm fuzzies. Everybody, I don't think there's any, as humans, I think we kind of know that. Again, if you know your spouse likes this or that, and you bring them the nicest cookies that they like or whatever, that's individual. And then, but I don't think that's male or female. I think that's just being a mensch. Being a mensch.
But I've been
him
a spouse, though.
Well, the spouse has to be a mensch to the other spouse. It doesn't, in whatever way they know to be. I don't think you get off the hook whether you're a man or a woman,
Okay. Question before your final thoughts. What kind of support or therapy or counseling or support group should we be looking for? Is it bereavement? Any therapist can do? What are we, if we are looking out for professional support?
Okay. Here's the thing. At this time, let's understand that we're still in a transitional period. And so a lot of the dust hasn't settled. Thank God, right? We don't know everything. For the good things, meaning for the bad things, rather. We don't know if somebody's been traumatized per se by this. We do know that people have been under a lot of stress. So again, and I can't say this enough, this is a good time to get support, even if it's not as bad as it could be, right? Now, support can come in a lot of forms. It could come in talking to people and just sharing. It could be online sharing with friends and just put together a Zoom group of friends. It could be there are lots of therapy support groups online, professionally led groups. It could be professional and non-professional, but to talk it out and to share experiences. That's step one. Not be isolated. Now, if something persists and it becomes entrenched and it becomes impossible to get past, whether it's in reality or in thinking, primarily in thinking, you might want to get some professional help. If you can't get out of a certain mindset, let's say you become overly anxious or you become stuck in some way and it's causing problems, there's help available. Now, which help, who help, obviously this depends on what's available to you. There are clinics, there are individual practitioners, there's all kinds of good stuff out there. And, of course, some of it will depend on your resources, whether it's financial or insurance resources or location. There are a lot of considerations. But help could be anything from just individual support to deeper work on some, losses or, entrenched traumatic experiences. Again, life is not easy, and people have had previous experiences. We're not blank slates. We've had other hardships. So it's not as though you went into this and everything was la-di-da fine. So if help is needed, don't be afraid. I think that there's an awful lot of us therapists out there. We've heard it all. We're ready to help. And there's no shame in it. If anything, I would say that there'd be a certain amount of you know, I don't want to say shame, but rahmanis, if you don't get help that's available, you know, you deserve to have a good life. You want to move forward. The whole idea is moving forward, not being stuck. And sometimes it doesn't take that much to get moving. It really doesn't. It doesn't have to be years worth of therapy. Sometimes an hour or two, figuring out a couple things, it could do wonders. So there are definitely hotlines and things like that. The Gedalia Society in the Shabbos has Gedalia Society medical hotline has a, if you press *1, you get medical advice, but *2 will get you to a licensed mental health person who, and in an anonymous way, you could ask your personal question. You can get some support, possibly referral or ideas. Again, that's the Gedalia Society medical hotline. *2 is mental health help. So right there, you've got a freebie. Amudim has a hotline. Ohel has a hotline. We're putting together another hotline for Neshamas. You can call neshamas.org, and we're putting together a hotline for them. So there's lots of help, even to run your personal situation by. And if you want to go further, of course, you could do that. So there's nothing to be shy about. That's what everybody's, you know, here for, and so forth. You know, more than that, I mean,
that's why we go into the helping field. They want.
That's why we really want exactly. You know, and
we want to. We want the world to have a better life, and sometimes it's just a few conversations and a change of perspective or some skills, and. So I mean, personally, I always felt that someone who did speak to a counselor or a therapist is sharing what they could have learned through a lot of mistakes. They're just getting the shortcut, skills and mindsets and happiness.
Yeah.
I also just wanted to throw into your list, MASC also does referrals for therapists.
That's right.
And relief.net does as well. And that can help you with the insurance and, location and type of situation. Some therapists work better with men, some with women. Some clients prefer men, some clients prefer women. Therapists work with you. I think this was so helpful. Do you have any final thoughts as we wrap up?
Well, I don't know. You know, if my thoughts could be helpful, I think one of the things is, you know, when you just ask what to do right now. At least in support of a spouse. Listen, 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 and then watch, watch, watch. Okay? That's the main thing. You start with that. And you start with assume the best, prepare for the worst. Now, the situation is hard. It doesn't have to be tragic. Okay? So maintain whatever regular expectations and lifestyle as much as you can. And then see how it goes. Don't assume that there will be a problem. Sometimes it just takes time for things to kind of reorganize themselves a bit. You know, you get to a new normal, right? So this is like a new normal. And call. And if you see signs of distress, whether they be behavioral or social withdrawal or attitude or excessive fears of anxieties, mood problems, self-blame, things like that, call us, call one of us. Well, some of us, it doesn't matter who.
And don't let money hold you back, because really, really, there's ways to pay for these situations.
Yeah.
And
there,
if you want to put it into perspective, if you don't take it, it could cost you long run. And definitely stress is... Stress is a consideration of what it's going to cause in the family. So there's ways to figure that also. Don't let money be the deterrent.
Listen, if anybody has a health insurance, generally speaking, you could get some help and licensed, qualified help. So money is not always the only, the thing. I think stigma sometimes, I think people lose, sort of energy, motivation. They kind of feel hopeless. Don't believe in your hopelessness. Okay? Don't believe it's all over or nothing can be done. It's a trick. Okay? Things can be done. Things can be changed. It's up to you, though, sometimes to get the shaliach, to get the helper, to make it happen.
Right.
That's my encouragement there. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So thank you.
Pleasure. Anytime.
And if any listener has any questions, on the recording, I'm going to add your reach you directly.
Okay. It's Elizabeth Jacobs. He's looking for that.
Where
they're
going to
find me.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. And if anyone have any other questions for Adayad, or want to reach out to any of the other resources, we'll put links onto the website. This will be put on the website. We made a special Adayad Animals and Resources for Corona, so it's adayad.org/corona, and lots of resources there, and it's also easy to remember. Adayad All AIDS. So thank you, Dr. Pinson, and good night to everybody.
Okay, thank you so much. Good night.
Good night.